Last time we ended up talking about scientific method and basic chemistry we need to understand from biology. Today what we want to start talking about is cells and how cells function. The first thing we need to talk about with cells is what we call the cell theory. The cell theory is basically how biologists define life. Okay? And so the first part of the cell theory is that all organisms consist of one or more cells. So in order to be considered living, these organisms must have at least one cell. Cells are the smallest living things, so we can't have things that are smaller than cells. We'll talk about some kind of pseudo-organisms a little bit later on in the semester called viruses, and why they're not really even considered to be living. Viruses aren't living, okay? Because they're smaller than a cell. And cells only arise by division of existing cells. So the only way that we can get new cells is by division of existing cells. Okay? We just can't get them out of nowhere. We have to, cells have to divide in order to get new cells. Any questions about the cell theory? So just to kind of give you an idea as to how large cells are, the amoeba there, which is one of the larger cells that you can find, is about 300 microns. A micrometer is 10 to the minus 9 meters. Okay, so these are very, very small. Human cheek cells are about 60 microns. When you look at a human cheek cell underneath a microscope, for example, that we have in the laboratory, if you magnify it 400 times, you can really just kind of barely see the cheek cell. So they're still very, very small. Something like a bacterium, Staphylococcus, which is a bacterium, is about a micron in size, so much smaller than a human cell. Right? Most of our human cells are probably pretty close to that human cheek cell as far as size is concerned. So the question is why are cells so small? Any idea? Really, it has to do with what we call surface area to volume ratio. Okay, so how much surface area does a substance have in relationship to its volume? So just as an example, if I were to draw two circles up here, a smaller one and a larger one, what's going to actually be true as far as surface area to volume ratio is the smaller circle is actually going to have a much larger surface area to volume ratio. So what we do here is we take the amount of surface area and relate it to how much volume is inside of the surface area. This larger circle is going to have a smaller surface area to volume ratio. In other words, there's not enough surface area, or there's not as much surface area in relationship to the volume of the circle. Okay? Any questions about that? So why this is important is if you have something with a small surface area to volume ratio, then anything inside of that cell, for example, if that dot were inside of a cell and the cell were this size, what would happen is it would actually take less time for that substance to communicate with the outside environment, okay? Because there's not as much volume that has to go through it. Are there any questions about that? Let me give you another example of surface area to volume ratio. How many of you have heard of something called cryogenics before? What's cryogenics? The idea that if you freeze something, it can come back to life later on, okay, kind of a thing. There was a movie about that that my wife liked, some dumb Mel Gibson movie. But the idea is that you can freeze a person, maybe, and bring them back to life later on. Where do we get such crazy ideas? Well, the answer is they're based in reality. You take something with a large surface area to volume ratio, such as a goldfish, a small goldfish, you drop it into liquid nitrogen, what happens is that entire goldfish will freeze instantaneously. If you then take the goldfish and put it back in a tank of water, it can actually survive, actually start living again once it thaws out. Now the reason why that occurs, or the reason why you can do that in a goldfish and not with a human, is because of surface area to volume ratio. What happens with the human is we have a whole bunch of cells, like layers of cells in our body, and if we were to dump a human into liquid nitrogen, What would happen is many of these cells would actually freeze instantaneously. But at some point, deep down in our skin here, or actually maybe even in our muscle, we would have cells that would have a freezing front. What that means is that half of the cell would freeze and maybe half of it wouldn't. Okay? When that happens, it damages cells. Okay? And so when, if we were to try and instantaneously freeze a human, there's too much volume in our body and we couldn't freeze the entire organism instantaneously. With the goldfish, they have a much larger surface area to volume ratio. And so we can freeze them instantaneously and then bring them out of the freezer, so to speak, and they're still alive. We do that with some human cells. If any of you have heard of sperm banks before, right? How do they store sperm for long periods of time in a sperm bank? They just basically dip them in liquid nitrogen and freeze them instantaneously. They can do that because sperm cells have a large surface area to volume ratio, and so the whole cell freezes instantaneously, and there's no freezing front. Does that make sense to everybody? Any questions about that? Now, could we ever freeze a human instantaneously? With the technology that we have today, probably not. Scientists have tried to use something similar in surface area to volume ratio to us. An animal that has a really similar surface area to volume ratio are rabbits. And so they've been trying to freeze rabbits instantaneously. And what they'll do is they'll insert a probe down the digestive tract all the way from the mouth to the anus, and then release liquid nitrogen both inside of the digestive tract and outside of the rabbit at the same instant. And when they do that, there's still too much volume in there, and not everything freezes instantaneously. But who's to say with future technology, maybe sometime in the future, you guys can go into a cryogenics place and freeze yourself until later on in history. Okay, who knows? But probably not likely because our surface area to volume ratio is too small. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, there are two main types of cells that we find in the world. The first is what we call prokaryotic cells. The prefix pro means before, karyotic means nucleus. So these are cells that do not have a nucleus. And as you can see, some of the characteristics up there, these cells lack a membrane-bound nucleus. They lack membrane-bound organelles. They're usually smaller, usually unicellular. That means that there's only one cell associated with these organisms. They're not multi-celled organisms, like we're a multi-celled organism. An example of a prokaryotic cell would be a bacterium. Okay. So they're usually smaller, usually unicellular. But the real key here is they lack a membrane-bound nucleus and a membrane-bound organelle, and membrane-bound organelles. Now if we contrast that with the other cell type, which is a eukaryotic cell, eukaryotic cells have membrane-bound organelles and a membrane-bound nucleus. Okay. They can be either unicellular or multicellular, and some examples of eukaryotic cells would be protists, fungi, plants, and animals. Okay, so we have eukaryotic cells. So what does it mean to have a membrane-bound nucleus and membrane-bound organelles? I'm going to show you some pictures of, first of all, some prokaryotic cells. Then I'm going to show you some pictures of some eukaryotic cells. We're going to talk about what a membrane-bound nucleus is and what membrane-bound organelles are. Basically, what organelles are in the cells is they are structures that help in the functioning of the cell. Okay. So if we look at a picture of a prokaryotic cell or a drawing, you can see that inside of the prokaryotic cell there's DNA. Okay, but there's really nothing else that you can visibly identify inside of the cell. And that DNA just looks like a mass of spaghetti in the middle of the cell. There's nothing that surrounds that DNA. So that does not have a membrane-bound nucleus, and there are no organelles in this cell. Okay. This is a micrograph of a bacterial cell. You can see that just the mass of DNA here in the center of the cell. There's really no organelles or anything else associated with this cell. Okay. If we look at a drawing of a eukaryotic cell, this is an animal cell, a drawing of an animal cell, we still see DNA, but the DNA is found within a well-defined structure or a membrane, and that's what we mean when we say a membrane-bound nucleus. So there's something that surrounds the DNA in our cell. Okay. In addition, you can see these other little structures, and you will know the names and the functions of those hopefully by the end of the next couple of class periods, right? And each of these other structures are what we call organelles, right? Any questions? So in prokaryotic cells, no membrane-bound nucleus, no membrane-bound organelle. Most of what we're going to talk about in this class, we're going to kind of focus on eukaryotic cells. Prokaryotic cells are only found in bacteria, and if you want to learn more about prokaryotic cells, you take a class called microbiology. Besides that, I'm not much of a microbiologist anyways, and so I mainly talk about eukaryotic cells. All right? So prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells actually have two things in common. They both have DNA, okay? However, in eukaryotic cells, that DNA is bound by a nucleus, right? And they both have a plasma membrane that surrounds the cell. And so this plasma membrane is what basically defines the cell. So if we look at the characteristics of the plasma membrane, basically the plasma membrane keeps cell content separate from the external environment. Another way of saying this is it's really what defines the cell. Okay, it's what makes a cell, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic. Okay? So if you think about this, what makes the science building the science building? Yeah, the red bricks that make up the walls, right? Or internally here, they're painted white. But that's really what makes the science building, is the walls of the science building, right? Same thing is true with the cell. The thing that defines the cell or makes a cell is the plasma membrane that surrounds the cell. Without a plasma membrane, you don't have a cell. Any questions? Okay, the plasma membrane helps in cell metabolism. We'll talk about how metabolism is affected by plasma membrane. This commonly occurs in the mitochondrion, a structure that we call the mitochondrion, or in plant cells it can occur in another organelle that we call the chloroplast. But the plasma membrane helps in cell metabolism. The plasma membrane exchanges substances to keep the cell in homeostasis. One of the things that the plasma membrane is able to do is to keep things that are supposed to be outside of the cell out, things that are supposed to be in, okay? And so sometimes those substances, either outside or inside of the cell, need to change. And so the plasma membrane allows for the exchange of those substances. The plasma membrane also helps the cell to recognize where it is and who's around it. Okay. This is very important for multicelled organisms like ourselves. For example, you don't want a toll cell taking up residence in your heart. Okay. So if a toll cell broke away and was carried up through the circulatory system, it could just start growing a new toll inside of your heart. What basically happens is if a cell realizes that the other cells around it are not of the same type, most of the time it will commit suicide, to tell you the truth. Okay? It just basically kills itself. So if you happen to get a toll cell and put it into your heart, the cells around your heart, that toll cell would basically commit suicide. Alright? Any questions? Okay, so let's take a look at the structure of the plasma membrane and where we have plasma membranes in cells. So all cells have plasma membrane that basically surrounds the cell. So if we look at this animal cell, the thing that basically is drawn here that defines the cell as a cell is a plasma membrane. Okay? And so we see the structure of the plasma membrane here. If we look at a plant cell, the same thing is true. Plasma membrane surrounds the plant cell. If we were to look at a bacterial cell, a prokaryotic cell, the same thing is true. The plasma membrane is what makes the cell the cell. Okay? Any questions? All right. So if we look at the structure of the plasma membrane is what we call a phospholipid bilayer. A phospholipid bilayer. Now, if you remember, we looked at the chemical structure of phospholipids on Monday. Okay, And if you remember the structure of phospholipids have two fatty acids, and then both of those fatty acids are attached to a glycerol molecule. So we had a glycerol molecule, and then we had two fatty acids with the long hydrocarbon chain attached to that fatty acid, or attached to the glycerol molecule. And then if you remember, the thing that made the phospholipids different from the fats was that instead of having the third fatty acid attached to the glycerol molecule, we had a phosphate group, remember? And there were some other molecules around the phosphate. Everybody remember that? And I talked a little bit about the structure. I said this part of the molecule here is hydrophilic. Remember that? It was polar, okay? And these long tail part of the molecule were hydrophobic, or they were nonpolar. All right? Any questions? And if you remember, I showed you how they would represent it in your textbook. The ball part of the molecule here is the hydrophilic part of the molecule, and then the two long hydrocarbon chains are the hydrophobic parts of the phospholipid molecule. Okay? So the plasma membrane is made up of a phospholipid bilayer. So there's two layers of phospholipids. Any questions? So this phospholipid bilayer is actually put together, I like to think of it kind of like a sandwich. Okay, you have the outer layers of your sandwich, which would be the bread, right? And then the stuff on the inside, the meat or whatever else you had on the inside of your sandwich. Okay, and that's kind of like the phospholipid bilayer. What we find is that the hydrophilic part of the phospholipid molecules make up the outside and the inside of the plasma membrane. So if you were to look at it in three dimensions, a cell here, draw a complete cell, and I've drawn two layers here. This represents the membrane. Okay. The hydrophilic part of the molecules of the phospholipid bilayer would be here and here. And then on the inside of this membrane, you would have those hydrophobic tails. Okay, something like this. Any questions?
The tails overlap, or is there a gap between them?
Yeah, they can overlap, or there can be a gap. Okay. Not a very good answer, but it can be either or. Generally, they probably overlap, to tell you the truth. And so what happens is, because of the structure of this membrane, because it is a phospholipid bilayer, it prevents almost everything from passing across the plasma membrane. And the reason why is this. Let's take, for example, a nonpolar substance. Could a nonpolar substance pass across the plasma membrane? Okay. It couldn't. Why? The minute it comes in contact with the pieces of bread or the outside layer, it's going to what? Be repelled, right? Okay, because light dissolves light, so different repels different, so to speak. Okay. So if we had a nonpolar substance, it wouldn't be able to make it through this outer layer. If we had a nonpolar substance inside of the cell, it wouldn't be able to make it through this inner layer. Okay? Any questions about that? What if we had a polar substance? Could it make it through the plasma membrane? It really couldn't, because it could make it through this outer layer, but could it make it through the middle of the sandwich, so to speak? It couldn't, because that's nonpolar. And so basically, the plasma membrane keeps polar substances from crossing it and nonpolar substances from crossing it. So what is there left? Yeah, basically there's not a lot that can cross the plasma membrane. It's very hard for substances to cross the plasma membrane, with a couple of exceptions, and the exceptions are these. Very small, uncharged molecules. And one of the few very small uncharged molecules that can pass freely across the membrane, plasma membrane, is a molecule we've talked about called water. Okay? Water is one of the very few molecules that can pass freely across the plasma membrane. Other than that, there are not many molecules that can pass freely across the plasma membrane. Okay? Any questions about that? So basically, not very many substances can pass across the plasma membrane. Now, sometimes what will happen is there will be proteins, and these proteins can actually work their way into the plasma membrane because of their chemical structure. They kind of trick the plasma membrane. And you can see a number of proteins that are sticking through the plasma membrane. Some of those proteins will have these, what type of molecule is this? A sugar or carbohydrate, right, that's attached to them. And these carbohydrates are actually kind of like the antennae of the cell. Remember we said the plasma membrane helps the cell to know who it is and where it is and who's around it. Okay. The way that it does that is with these carbohydrates. Other proteins are hollow on the inside, and these are what we call channel proteins. Channel proteins allow substances to move freely across the plasma membrane because it tricks the plasma membrane, so to speak. Okay? It's kind of like this. Can a stream of water run directly under a road without anything to help it? It can't, right? I mean, it might percolate, but it doesn't run directly underneath the road. So what do you need to have water running underneath the road? A culvert, right? The round thing that the water goes through. Well, these channel proteins, they're kind of like culverts, okay? And what they allow is they allow certain substances to move freely through the protein. Now, for each substance that needs to move freely across the plasma membrane, they have to have different culverts. So let's say a culvert that allows sodium ions to pass freely across the plasma membrane, it will not allow potassium ions to move freely across the plasma membrane. Does that make sense? So you would need a separate culvert or channel protein to move potassium across the plasma membrane.
Are they one way or do they
allow? They can actually be either way. Yeah, their movement can occur in either direction. Now, typically, these channel proteins are not just open channel proteins. What they are is they're what we call gated channel proteins. And so they actually have a little gate. So if this were the culvert here, they would actually have a gate inside of there. And what happens is the cell is either, these gates are either opened or closed depending on what the cell needs at a particular time. Okay. So a plasma membrane may have thousands of these channel proteins, and most of them may have their gates shut. Sometimes there are channel proteins that are produced by certain people because of their genetic makeup, in which the gates cannot be shut, and it causes, I guess you'd call it a disease, a genetic disease. For example, one example of this is, many of you ever heard of cystic fibrosis before? Cystic fibrosis is caused by a channel protein in which the channel protein, the gate doesn't work properly. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay, now in addition, the plasma membrane is what we call a fluid mosaic. Okay, a fluid mosaic. What that means is that these phospholipid molecules do not stay in one place. They're constantly moving around. All right? It's not like most substances that you're familiar with. They actually move around and they're what we call a fluid mosaic. Okay, so just kind of a hypothetical example, if this were a real plasma membrane and we were able to mark this phospholipid molecule here with an X, if we came back in 5 minutes, that phospholipid molecule may be here, it may be over here. Okay, so these phospholipid molecules are constantly moving. And this is very important for cells. Right? It gives them a non-solid structure. Probably the best analogy that you guys might be familiar with a fluid mosaic model are bubbles. Right? And when I say bubbles, you know, I have little kids, the bubbles that my little kids play with, all of you know what I'm talking about, right? If you take a bubble, or you take a bottle of bubbles and you dip the little ring thing down in the bubbles, right? And you blow on the bubble, it doesn't just pop, you make a whole bunch of bubbles as you blow, right? And that's because that soap film is actually a fluid mosaic, okay? Let me give you a couple of examples of how this is different from a solid structure. Something that's kind of similar to bubbles are balloons, right? If you have a balloon and it's full of air, and you stick that balloon with a pin so that it doesn't pop, stick it with a pin, and then you pull the pin out, what's going to happen to that balloon?
It's
going to deflate, right? Because the balloon is a solid, and you've breached the integrity of that solid, so to speak. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, what if you had one of those rings with the film of bubbles on them? Could you put a pin through it and then pull it back out? Would it break that film? It actually wouldn't, okay, because it's a fluid mosaic. The same thing is true with the cell. If you were to stick a pin down through this plasma membrane here, you actually wouldn't really damage the cell membrane, because that pin would actually, as it was hitting the plasma membrane, those phospholipid molecules would actually move out of the way a little bit and then surround the pin. And then when you pulled the pin out, they can move, and so they would basically close the hole as you pulled the pin out. Okay, does that make sense to everybody? Any questions about that? So again, the plasma membrane is a fluid mosaic, which means that it's the phospholipid molecules within the plasma membrane are mobile. They're not a static molecule. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so where would we find plasma membrane again in the cell? Well, we find plasma membrane surrounding the cell itself. We also find plasma membrane surrounding each of these organelles. By definition, a eukaryotic cell is a cell that has a membrane-bound nucleus. Okay, so membrane around the nucleus here, and membrane-bound organelles, or organelles that are made up, essentially defined by membranes. Okay, so the membrane that's in this nucleus, or the membrane that's in this organelle here, the endoplasmic reticulum, it has the exact same structure as the membrane out here surrounding, or at least maybe not the nucleus, but it has basically the same structure as the membrane that surrounds the cell. And so around each of these organelles would be a phospholipid bilayer. Okay? Around the nucleus, there is a phospholipid bilayer. It's a little bit different, but it's still a phospholipid bilayer. Okay? Any questions about that? So let's talk about how a cell functions. And as we talk about how the cell functions, realize that as I teach you stuff in biology, what I'm hoping that you understand is the basics of biology. We're not going to go into a lot of detail about how cells function, but I'm going to talk about the basics of how cells function. You can take an entire class or multiple classes on how exactly the cell functions. Okay. But we're just going to kind of give you a general overview of how the cell functions. And so, as we talk about how the cell functions, I'm going to use an analogy. It may not be a perfect analogy, as most analogies are not perfect, but hopefully, I think it helps students to understand what's going on in the cell a little bit better. And we're going to compare the cell to a factory. Okay. Now, if you have any type of a factory, that factory is going to produce a product, right? Does that make sense? So, for example, if you have a car factory, their product are cars. Okay, easy enough. When the cell, the factory of the cell, the main product that's produced from that factory is something that we call protein. Okay, so we've talked about what proteins are and their chemical makeup. And so proteins are going to be the basic product that's produced in the factory of the cell. Any questions? So, by the time we're done talking about how the cell functions, you should be able to identify each of these different organelles by sight, and you should be able to tell me essentially, kind of in basic terms, what each of these structures do. Okay? So, the first structure that we want to talk about is the nucleus, right? This large central structure. Usually the nucleus is found somewhere in the middle of the cell. And the nucleus, if we look close up, is a little bit different from other organelles. And we'll talk about why it is different. But it has a phospholipid bilayer. You can see that phospholipid bilayer depicted right here. But notice that there are proteins that are channel proteins. And these particular channel proteins don't have gates. They're just basically holes in the membrane of the nucleus. Okay, so that's how the plasma membrane of the nucleus differs from other plasma membranes, is it just has a bunch of holes in it. Okay, and we'll talk about why they have that. Now, the key component of the nucleus, in this picture here, because of the light, you can't see it very well. But this is just a depiction, remember. But it just kind of looks like a bunch of lines inside of here. And what that is depicting is it's depicting DNA. Okay? So DNA is what is found within the nucleus. And now, using our analogy, we're going to call DNA the boss of the cell. Okay? The DNA decides what is going to be produced and how much is going to be produced. So it's, most of you have worked before, and at every job you've ever worked, there's one person, maybe more than one, that's the boss, right? The ultimate boss. Actually, everywhere you've worked, there's probably only one ultimate boss, right? And that one ultimate boss determines what's going to happen in that factory. Does that make sense to everybody? The boss of the cell is DNA. Right? And DNA is found within the nucleus. Now, just to kind of expand our analogy a little bit, basically what the plasma membrane, or the nuclear membrane, does is it separates the boss from all the workers in the cell. Okay? Most of the time when you go to work, you don't like to see your boss looking over your shoulder, right? 24 hours a day. You like to have your boss sitting in his office or her office and to not bother you too much. They just give you instructions and let you do your job. That's kind of how the cell functions. The DNA is found within the nucleus, and so the boss doesn't really interact with the worker bees, so to speak. Okay? Any questions? But the boss has to make decisions, so the boss needs information from the workers, right? The boss also needs to tell the workers what they need to do. And so to allow for that communication, that's why there are holes in the nuclear membrane, as we see here. Okay? Those holes are in the nuclear membrane. Any questions about that? Okay. So there are holes in the nuclear membrane. And those holes allow for the boss to communicate with the workers of the factory. Right? Any questions? So to use another analogy, those holes, you know, you kind of think of a car factory, the boss sitting in a glass cubicle in the middle of the factory, and there are going to be little cubby holes that you can pass messages back and forth to and from the boss. Does that make sense? That's what the pores are in the plasma membrane of the nucleus. Another modern analogy would be, it might be the digital data lines that allow you to communicate with the boss via email. Any questions about that? So basically, the function of the nucleus is where the DNA is housed, where we find the DNA, or the boss of the cell. Now, one thing that doesn't fit our analogy real well is there's typically another structure found inside of the nucleus called the nucleolus. And this structure doesn't really fit our analogy perfectly, but we're going to fit it in a little bit, right? Now, before you can produce any product in any factory, you need a couple of things, right? What are they?
Material.
Okay, you need the materials. Now, as far as the cell's concerned and materials, we're just going to assume for our purposes in here that the materials are always in the cell, okay? And that's somewhat true. Okay. What else do you need besides materials?
Blueprint.
Okay, you need blueprints. And the DNA is going to provide the blueprint. The boss is going to make up the blueprint. What else do you need?
Workers.
Okay, you need workers, that's true. But before you even have workers, you need something else. Okay, you need a place to put it, and that's what the whole cell is.
You need money.
Right? But you need tools to make the product, right? In other words, before you get workers, you have to have the tools to make the product, correct? Does that make sense? And that's what's produced inside of the nucleolus, are the tools to make the product. So you can kind of think of it in our analogy of the car factory. The tools that are needed to make a car are some welders, right? Some automatic welders. Well, in the cell, the tools are what we call ribosomes. And so ribosomes are the tool that we find within the cell. And those ribosomes are produced in the nucleolus. So it really doesn't fit our analogy perfectly, but it somewhat does, right? So inside of the boss's office, not only do we have the boss, DNA, we also have kind of a mini factory that makes the tools that we need to produce our product, proteins. And those tools are what we call ribosomes. That's another reason why there are pores in the nuclear membrane, so that the tools can pass from the nucleus out to the rest of the cell. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so if we look at a cell, and we're going to go over this numerous times, you guys might even get bored with it, but we know what this structure is called right here. What is this structure called? The nucleus. And what's the function of the nucleus? Okay, it houses what? DNA, which is the boss of the cell, right? Okay. It also houses another structure called the nucleolus, which is what? It's where the tools are made, and the tools that are made are called ribosomes. What's different about the plasma membrane of the nucleus versus other plasma membranes? It has basically holes in it. Those holes are used for communication and also to be able to move ribosomes into and out of the nucleus. Okay? Any questions? Alright, the next structure, the next organelle that we want to talk about in the cell then, is this structure that's shown in blue up here in this picture. This is what we call the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? The endoplasmic reticulum. Now, if we look at the endoplasmic reticulum close up, what the endoplasmic reticulum looks like is it looks like a series of tubes or tunnels. Okay? And you can see, so you see all of these little tubes in this case, or kind of like a big cave or a tunnel here in this case. Now, what makes the ER? What surrounds the ER? Plasma membrane, right? Plasma membrane. So, a phospholipid bilayer, this structure that's depicted here in the picture is actually a phospholipid bilayer, right? Okay. Now, the main function of the ER is, the ER is basically the workbench or the work floor of our factory. This is where we're going to produce the product. Okay. So if we're thinking again of our analogy of a car factory, the welders that are used to produce the car are found on the work floor, right? The same thing is true with the ER. And by the way, ER, I'll use that term because it's kind of hard to say endoplasmic reticulum all the time. Okay. So the ER is kind of like the workbench of the cell. Right? Any questions? Now on the workbench, you're going to have your tools. And that's what is depicted by these little black dots. Each of those little black dots represent a tool. And our tools are called what? Ribosomes. Okay, so the ribosomes land on the ER. Now there are basically two types of ER. There's what we call rough ER and smooth ER. Okay, the rough ER is very simple to define. That's the workbench or the part of the workbench where you find ribosomes. So the ribosomes make it look kind of rough, like sandpaper. Does that make sense, everybody? So that's rough ER. So this is where the proteins are going to be produced. Smooth ER, on the other hand, has no ribosomes on it. And to tell you the truth, as scientists, we don't really understand why smooth ER is even found in the cell or what the purpose of smooth ER is. It's one question on the test. If I asked you, what's the function of smooth ER? You could put it down, I don't know, and you'd get it right. Okay. Some scientists think that it's new ER, some scientists think that it's old ER, some scientists think, actually there's a term, there's some scientists that think that there may be an additional function that smooth ER conducts. We're just not sure right now. Okay. Any questions about that? So let's talk about how the protein is produced on the ER, okay? What this picture is depicting is a piece of endoplasmic reticulum. And remember, the endoplasmic reticulum is kind of like a series of tubes or tunnels, right? So here's our tube or tunnel. So this part is plasma membrane here, okay? Now, on our workbench, we're going to have tools. Our tools are called ribosomes, correct? Okay. Now, he said that the main product that's produced in the cell is what?
Proteins.
Now, what makes proteins? What are proteins made of?
Amino acids.
Amino acids. Good. Okay. So how do we get amino acids to connect to one another to make a complex protein? Through what process? Through condensation. Good. Okay. So what we learned before, we're actually using a little bit now, right, to understand what's going on here. And so basically, the protein is made amino acid by amino acid at the side of the ribosome. Now we'll kind of give you the rest of the story about how the cell knows which amino acids to bring to the ribosome a little bit later on in the semester. But for right now, just kind of understand that amino acids are brought to the ribosome. And they're put together at the side of the ribosome through the process of condensation. Okay. Now, as the protein is being produced, the completed part of the protein is put into the center or the tube-like part of the ER. So, if you can kind of think of another analogy here, this desk has a hole in it. Okay. So this desk is hollow on the inside. There's a computer and everything in there right now. Correct. But if we kind of use the analogy of this desk being the endoplasmic reticulum, it kind of works well, right? We have this workbench, we put a tool on it, okay? And then what we bring is we bring amino acids and start adding the amino acids together to make a complex protein, all right? Kind of imagine the amino acids being beads of a necklace. Most of you have made necklaces before, at least most of you probably have, right? And you make a necklace by putting one bead at a time on a string, correct? Okay. So imagine us having this string here over our hole and our tool. As we put another bead on, the completed part of the necklace is down on the inside of the desk. Does that make sense? So the top part, the string is up here. We add another bead, and as we add that bead, we drop that down into the center part of the desk here. Okay. It's basically how proteins are produced. Excuse me. On the ER, okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so what we end up with is we end up with a string of amino acids or a protein down inside of the center of the endoplasmic reticulum, okay? Any questions about how that happens? Okay, so pretty soon, using our analogy, we'd have our necklace done, and when we complete our necklace, we drop it down into this hollow desk. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, the analogy is not perfect because at this point, what happens is that that protein has weight to it, right? It's made up of amino acids. And as it falls into the inside of the ER, remember the ER is made of phospholipid bilayer, right? The plasma membrane around it. And that plasma membrane, is it solid? It's not. And so what the protein does is it actually pushes against the side of the ER. And as it pushes against the side of the ER, that ER starts to bulge out. Okay? And pretty soon the weight of the protein is too much for the ER, or the plasma membrane of the ER. So what's going to happen is a little piece of that plasma membrane is going to break off with just the protein inside of it. Okay? And at that point we call it a transport vesicle. Right? Now that's not going to shatter the ER. Why? Yeah, the ER is a fluid mosaic, so it's just going to hook back together. Okay, this is where our bubble analogy works pretty good. Okay, same analogy. If I have a little ring with soap bubbles in it, right, that my kids like to watch, what do? I blow on it. So I'm putting pressure on it, kind of like the proteins putting pressure on the plasma membrane. Okay. As more and more pressure is applied to that salt bubble, what eventually happens? It closes up and a piece of the bubble floats away, right? But there's still a salt film in the circle if I don't blow them all out, right? Does that make sense to everybody? Similar to what's happening here in the ER, okay? We're putting pressure on that plasma membrane, and that plasma membrane stretches out, and a piece of it breaks off with the protein on the inside of it. And then you still have the endoplasmic reticulum there. Okay. Any questions about that? So now our protein is completed. It's in a transport vesicle. And so what's going to happen to the transport vesicle? You can probably safely assume. It's going to be transported, right? Okay. Easy enough.
But where is it going to be transported to is the question.
Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so just kind of a review, and then we'll probably end here after we review and talk about the other organelles on Friday. But we know what this structure is right here. What's this structure?
Nucleus.
It's the nucleus. The nuclear membrane is different from other plasma membrane. Why? It has protein holes in it. Okay, and why are those holes there? So that the cell can communicate with DNA, and so the DNA can communicate with the cell. So DNA is found within the nucleus, and what's the function of DNA? It's the boss of the cell. Okay, it's what controls the cell, the big boss. Also inside the nucleus is this structure called the nucleolus. And what's produced in the nucleolus?
Ribosomes.
And ribosomes are like the tools that are used to make the protein, right? Okay. Any questions so far? We now know what this blue, or structure that's depicted in blue in this picture, is called. It's called the what? The endoplasmic reticulum, or ER. There's smooth ER and rough ER. What makes them different? Ribosomes are on rough ER. Okay, how does the, if you look up here, how does the plasma, or how does the ER differ in its characteristics from these other organelles? What makes it different? What? Okay, it looks like tubes or tunnels, exactly. Okay. So it looks like a series of tubes or tunnels. That's what makes it look different. What's the function of the ER? Okay, it's kind of like the workbench or work floor of the cell. So we bring the tools, the ribosomes, put it on the work floor, right, or on the workbench, and then the proteins are made, amino acid by amino acid, through the process of condensation. As those amino acids hook together and produce a complex protein, then what happens is that protein pushes against the plasma membrane of the ER, and eventually the ER kind of stretches out, and a piece of it breaks off and surrounds the protein itself. When it does that, what do we call that? A transport vesicle. And you can actually see some transport vesicles, for example, right here in the cell. Now, where these transport vesicles are going to transport the protein, we're not going to talk about it a lot in detail, is to this organelle right here called the Golgi apparatus. Another name for it is the Golgi complex, okay, or just the Golgi. And we're going to talk about the function and structure of the Golgi next. Okay. Any questions? All right. On Friday, we're going to continue talking about how cells function. So if you've read the two chapters on the cell, you should be ahead of the game. You need to read those two chapters, okay? Okay, we'll see you on Friday.